Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine, Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and welcome back to one of our all-time favorite guest co-hosts, Dr. Bob Gwaither. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you, Adam. It's good to be here.
You know, we've got an exciting show today. We're going to be talking with Dr. Robert Dubrow, professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health and the faculty director of the Yale Climate Change and Health Initiative, about climate change and public health and getting some updates. This is something we've talked about several years ago on the show, and a lot's happened. I'm really looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, and it's politically really on the table now with all the changes in the new president cabinets and stuff.
Yeah, well, hopefully we'll be able to inform ourselves and inform our listeners. And speaking of informing, we have some interesting research that matters. And let's dive into our very first study about long-term use of opioids, those painkillers. And does it matter, like, where you first got it from? If you went to the doctor and you got it from one doctor and maybe the same condition, you went to another doctor and you didn't get it, does that really matter?
And this is a great study for academics because it has 375,000 Medicare patients that were followed for 3 years.
That's a lot.
And as well as the physicians who wrote the prescriptions for them in the emergency department. So this is all based on emergency department prescriptions.
Yeah, this was actually research that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And basically what they wanted to see is if you go, let's say, with a sprained ankle, for instance, to the emergency room, are you more likely to get an opioid from one physician compared to going and getting another? One would think same patient, same condition, you probably would get treated the same. Nope, it doesn't work like that. And if you were able to or were given a prescription for an opioid, were you much more likely to develop long-term opioid addiction? And the answer is, surprisingly, yes. This is a big deal.
And Dr. Michael Barnett, who is an assistant professor of health policy at Harvard School of Public Health.
He really was worried about these patients. You know, are there doctors that are giving these prescriptions out perhaps too much or too quickly instead of non-opioid prescriptions for patients presenting in the emergency room?
And he points out that there's no consensus for whether to use it, how much to use it, how often to use it among emergency room physicians. And so there's a natural difference between them depending on philosophy.
Yeah, these doctors that were high-intensity prescribers, they sent 1 in 4 patients home from the emergency room with opioids. Low-intensity prescribers gave opioids to 1 in 14. Now, that may not be a big deal, except that the patients who went to the high-intensity prescriber were 30% more likely to become long-term opioid users. In other words, patient comes back to see us in the office, and they said, you know, I was in the emergency room. I had this pain. They gave me some Percocets, and, you know, could you give me another prescription? And the doctors are more likely to probably give them if they've had them before. It suggests to me, Bob, that we have a long way to go, but we should be emphasizing clearly non-opioids when patients come to the emergency room as the first, second, and third line treatment.
And the treatments don't have to be meds all the time. It can also be other things like massage therapy or acupuncture. So there's a lot of possible solutions to trying to deal with this. But we also ought to involve the patient in it because they clearly need to know that addiction is a possible thing once they start an opioid. And that's what this shows. The doctors that prescribed more opioids had more people 6 months later taking opioids, continuing to take opioids.
A little worrisome. We're going to jump into something that's also kind of worrisome, but also not studied very much. And this has to do with depression among men whose wives are pregnant. So a lot of times we think about perinatal care, prenatal care, the woman and the child and the health and how the woman's health can affect the child's health. In this particular case, it suggests that we should be paying a real attention also to the father's health and impacts that they may have around pregnancy.
And this is done by Dr. Lisa Underwood at the University of Auckland in New Zealand, and they basically decided to start checking out the dads instead of only doing the pregnant women. And they studied people during the pregnancy, they gave him a questionnaire, and then 9 months after the baby was born, they gave him a questionnaire to see if there was differences between those two time periods or how big the problem was of depression in these men occurs.
And 2.3% of the fathers had depressive symptoms kind of before the birth of the child, and 4.3% of the fathers had depressive type symptoms 9 months after the child was born. And if the father has elevated depressive symptoms, there's much more likely to have stress and poor health in the family unit. And it, again, this is worrisome. This was published in the Journal of American Medical Association, subspecialty journal of psychiatry. What do you think we do with this, Bob?
Well, I think we just take it into our cognition that this is likely to happen and check them out for depression. And then you should have a screening instrument to do that. If they have it, it's important to try to deal with it because it probably would be worse during postpartum time when the baby's there and needs some attention.
Our next research that matter, we'll see if we're in agreement on this. It has to do with when one is doing endurance athletic competitions or even just 10Ks, 5Ks, the sorts of things, 3 miles, 6 miles. Does it matter that you can improve your quality of your time by swishing your mouth with rinse?
And this was done by an avid athlete.
From the University of Georgia and researchers. And they actually were swishing several different things to determine if it improved the times. It was a sucrose or sugar solution. The sucrose solution, low-intensity artificial sweetener, and a high-intensity artificial sweetener, and comparing this with water. And basically, they said, because they had each athlete was going through a time trial with all these different formulations, that if you had a rinse with something that actually had a little bit of energy in the mouth, you got something that improved the time as compared to an artificial sweetener that did not.
So it actually showed pretty dramatic results because the real sugar, as opposed to the sucralose, which has no calories, was able to change times. And it was remarkable that they improved their scores up to 3 minutes on a 10K.
And they didn't swallow this. They just swished it in their mouth and presumably maybe spit it.
Yeah, and they did. They did that 4 times during the run, and they did each of the solutions. I think it was 8 times during the run, and each of the 4 solutions on each of the 16 people that participated.
And there may have been some part of this that was about the taste of it, because tasting something sweet seemed to have had some impact, but clearly there may be something else going on here. My bottom line on this, Bob, is it really matters a lot more if you're in shape. And if you've been practicing and you're a good runner, that really makes a big difference. Maybe for the elite athlete, it's worth looking at. But I'd like to see the kind of the gold standard that we talk about, the randomized controlled trial here. It's an easy one to actually do, and we can see if it makes any difference, because I can see a lot of marketing going on pushing whatever increases the time of these endurance athletes. What about our last research that matters? MRIs, magnetic resonance imaging, to study the brains of infants who have a sibling that has autism. Bad disease, difficult disease. Can we diagnose it early through the use of something like an MRI?
And the time at diagnosis for this prior to this study was generally about 24 months of age to see if the sibling with autism actually increases the chance of the newborn to do it. And they did several MRIs on a lot of babies. And this was done here at UNC by a Dr. Joseph Priven.
And it was actually published in the journal Nature, one of the most prestigious journals. And they did MRIs on infants at 6, 12, and 24 months of age. And then they put it all into the fancy computer and did an algorithm and figured out, could they predict? And they said they could predict which of these siblings whose sibling had autism was going to go and develop the autism themselves at a younger age than they could have otherwise in 8 out of the 10 infants. Now, that suggests that it's not a perfect test. In addition, I didn't really see much discussion of if someone could possibly have a positive test but not go on to develop it. So this test to me is not ready for prime time, but it's an interesting research that suggests that we're moving towards younger ages in which we can diagnose autism.
Right, and perhaps there's going to be treatments available to those younger people.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Robert Dubrow, professor of epidemiology at Yale School of Public Health, about changing climate and how that affects public health and what can be done. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Bob Gwyther. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. Today on Conversations, Bob, we're talking with Dr. Robert Dubrow, professor of epidemiology at Yale School of Public Health and faculty director of the Yale Climate Change and Health Initiative, about how the changing climate affects public health and what can be done. Welcome, Dr. Dubrow.
Well, thank you, Adam, and thanks for inviting me to be on your show.
Well, you know, we always are really interested in the research, but we're even more interested in the person behind the programs. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, historically, my area of interest has been both cancer and HIV epidemiology, and I've been doing that work at the School of Public Health since around 1987. But about 3 or 4 years ago, time started to seem more precious, and I realized my career won't last forever. So I started thinking seriously about the remainder of my career and if I wanted to do anything different. And since the mid-1980s or so, I followed the issue of climate change very closely, but never worked on it professionally. But I'd actually come to believe that climate change is the greatest long-term threat to public health. And at the same time, that tackling climate change presented a really crucial public health opportunity. And I was influenced actually by a sentiment expressed in a very different context by Martin Luther King, but is very applicable, I believe, to climate change, where he said, "We are now faced with the fact that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In this unfolding conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late." That really affected me. I thought that really applies to the situation that humanity is in right now with regard to climate change. So I finally made the decision that if I could figure out how to do it, I wanted to devote the rest of my career to climate change and health. And fortunately, about a year and a half ago now, in collaboration with my dean here and some other faculty, we were able to obtain some funding to start our climate change and health initiative, which I am directing. So I've been doing that for about the last year and a half.
Can you tell us a bit about the relationship between climate change and health?
Sure. So the big picture is that the aim of public health is to create the conditions in which people can be healthy. And one of those conditions is a stable climate for a number of reasons. So let me present a brief catalog of the health effects that we've already observed, as well as health effects that we can project will emerge in the future. So some are obvious direct effects. For example, we know that the frequency of extreme weather events has been increasing and will continue to increase. And those events, such as heat waves, floods, droughts, and storms, result in injuries, sickness, and deaths. Secondly, with regard to heat, occupational heat stress is a very big concern, particularly for outdoor workers, such as agricultural and construction workers, because they have no choice but to be working outdoors at all times of the year. In addition, we have concerns about infectious diseases, vector-borne diseases, for example, mainly those carried by mosquitoes. Mosquitoes like hot and humid weather. That's the bottom line. So there are concerns about major mosquito-borne diseases such as malaria, dengue, chikungunya, and Zika. There's exacerbation of air pollution. So we're seeing more wildfires, which create air pollution. And even though wildfires occur in forests, they create a tremendous amount of pollution that often ends up drifting and creating air pollution problems for cities. We also are seeing and expect to see higher levels of pollen and mold in the air.
These are overwhelming. I want to give a pause for a second because I want to ask a question, because we did a show probably 5 or 6 years ago on climate change. And at the time, we could be kind of hearing a similar sort of anticipated effects. I think it's more compelling even because the data continues to accumulate. And I guess one of the questions is, given where we're at in the political discourse in, let's say, the U.S., perhaps some other countries, are we just in a blip of some folks not believing this and therefore it becomes part of the alternative facts? Or are we've gone from 90 to 95 to 98% of scientists, we keep moving as we get more knowledge of the health effects, we also keep moving with less people willing to deny it?
It's interesting. The climate denial is mainly restricted to the United States. Most of the rest of the world does not have, there's no controversy about the existence of and importance of climate change. So that's one point. But that's serious because we're, in many ways, the world's leader, and other countries follow us. So I think you've identified a very serious issue, especially because there had been important, although somewhat limited, progress made over the last 4 years or so with climate change, including things like executive actions by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to reduce emissions. The Pope produced an important encyclical on climate change. There have been some successful popular mobilizations, for example, that resulted in the U.S. government rejecting the Keystone XL pipeline and also suspending the Dakota Access Pipeline construction, and those, of course, have already been reversed. There's also been progress by having the 2015 Paris Agreement, which is definitely flawed, but on the other hand, it provides a floor that we could build on. There were other indications of progress as well. I'll mention one other, which is the rapidly decreasing costs of solar and wind energy, which is a very important piece of economic progress. But now we've reached an important bump in the road with the election of President Trump. And I don't want to put this as a political issue of criticizing him or not criticizing him personally. It's more the policies that he's advocated and already started to implement, which are exactly the opposite of what we need. So his policy, I would summarize as something that Sarah Palin had also advocated, which is drill, baby, drill, produce as much fossil fuels as possible, whereas what we need is a rapid conversion from a fossil fuel-based energy system to a renewable energy-based system. So we have a really big challenge ahead of us.
I can remember back in the 60s, people were worried about us running out of fossil fuels. I'm not so sure that's a concern now. Obviously, we could continue to use them at a lower rate, but I think trying to get things to supplant that, even when they still exist, probably makes more sense.
Yeah, so let me actually make one point about that's very important. The world, including through the Paris Agreement, has agreed that we need to limit warming to less than 2 degrees centigrade above the pre-industrial levels. And there's debate about whether even doing that will really avoid catastrophic change, but it might. And in any event, that's probably the practical limit at this point. And the warming is pretty much proportional to cumulative CO2 emissions. So we know that we've already used up more than 70% of those emissions. We could say that the world has a carbon budget, which currently is roughly 220 gigatons of carbon, meaning that that's how much carbon we could still burn and have a reasonable chance of staying below the 2 degrees centigrade limit. So that's 220. Now, the proven fossil fuel reserves are more than 760 gigatons of carbon. And we know what the goal of having those reserves is. The way that fossil fuel companies make money is to extract those reserves, sell them, and see them burned. So that's 760 versus 220. So you could see the predicament that we're in. in terms of trying to limit carbon emissions and stay below the 2 degrees centigrade goal.
It is, and it's kind of disheartening to see that the White House has scrubbed the mention of climate change from its computer rolls, and we've got a new EPA program director who has sued the EPA, and it just doesn't seem like a favorable way to try to deal with this. But we need to take a short break. When we return, okay, we'll be talking to Dr. Robert Dubrow, professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health and the faculty director of the Yale Climate Change and Health Initiative, about how the changing climate affects of public health and what we are doing.
We'll be right back with your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Bob Gwyther. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Bob Gwyther. Bob and I have been talking with Dr. Robert Dubrow, professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health and director of the Yale Climate Change and Health Initiative, about climate change and public health and I think really what can be done. And Dr. Dubrow reminds me of an old adage that my father, blessed memory, used to say to me, which is, you know, Adam, worry about something that you can do something about. And what I'm impressed by you, and what sounds like a relatively short period of time that you've been doing this, is you're doing something about it. You've established a class, a course you're teaching at Yale, a practicum in climate change. Tell us about the course. How'd you get started? And more importantly, what are y'all doing about it?
Sure. So actually, believe it or not, I've established two courses, which is nice. So one is a standard didactic course about climate change and public health, but the other one that you referred to is called Practicum in Climate Change Sustainability and Public Health, and that's kind of a more innovative course. And so essentially we have, and I'm teaching that right now, we have four students per team that are working on four different projects related to climate change, sustainability, and public health. I'll tell you the titles of the projects. So one is reducing automobile use for short workday trips by Yale employees. The second is bacterial contamination in Long Island Sound, improving beach closure policy and assessing the effects of climate change. The third one is carbon footprint impact of reduction in unnecessary medical testing in a hospital clinic. And finally, you'll like this one, developing a healthy, sustainable, and tasty pizza for Yale events.
I think Bob and I need to come up and taste that.
Right.
We'll happily do that.
How are the students reacting to this? I mean, these all sound like this kind of, you can do something that's local, you can do something that's regional. Some of them sound more scientifically based with some research versus some of them need to maybe be implemented. I suspect the challenges are different for each.
Right. Really, they're all four of them are local projects. But the idea is that this is a problem. The problem of climate change is a global problem, and it needs to be addressed at all levels, starting with the level of international treaties like the Paris Agreement, then national level, which U.S. isn't doing a great job on now, the state and local government level, the level of institutions such as Yale University. So that's one of the levels we're working on, such as the project for reducing automobile use and for developing the healthy, sustainable pizza. We're working on the local government level for the bacterial contamination project. We're working with one of the local health districts here that is responsible for the health on some of the beaches on Long Island Sound. Even there are things people could do, your listeners could do, at the individual level.
Like what?
So, and this is climate change and health. So get out of your car for short trips and walk or use a bicycle. So that results in less CO2 emissions. It also is healthy to do. Physical activity is one of the best things that you could do to promote your health. Secondly, eat less meat and more fruits and vegetables. It's very good for your health. And it turns out that The production of meat also generates a lot of methane, which is an important greenhouse gas in addition to carbon dioxide. So eating less meat and more fruits and vegetables helps on both the climate change front and the personal health front. Install solar panels on your roof is another thing. You know, everyone can't do that, but if you can, that's a great thing to do. And as I alluded to previously, it's also cost-effective. And then just think about ways you can conserve household energy. So those are some individual things that could be done. But let me also stress that individual action, I believe, is very important, and it helps create a culture of sustainability. But it's really not enough, that we really need to work on these other levels in order to solve this problem, especially the level of government policy. So in addition to taking these individual steps, I would urge your listeners to vote for candidates who support climate action, call and write letters to government officials, make your voice heard by participating even in peaceful protests, if that's the kind of thing that you're bent to do.
I think it's really, really great that you're getting young people, young smart people in your situation, with their hands on a project that they can actually tackle. And whether they saw that one or not, they may get interested and bitten by the bug and, you know, turn into the sorts of people that can have that bigger national or international approach.
Yeah, well, I really hope so. Being a professor here for a long time now, so I keep getting older, but the students keep staying in their, mainly in their 20s. And so it's great to be interacting with young people and to be affected by their idealism and their wanting to do what's good for society.
Your climate change and health initiative has probably got a lot more than medical students in it. So what sorts of health professionals or other professionals are involved?
So it's actually mainly Master of Public Health students. There are no medical students, actually. But in addition to them, we have... So it's a small class. As I said, there are four teams of four students, so 16 students. We have 9 public health students and 7 Yale undergraduates in the course.
Mm. You know, when I think about to what my own contribution is, because you went from kind of individual things to societal things, but I think really people have to understand, what is your carbon footprint? And I'm thinking back to how one way I got educated was when my son, who was at Kenyon and was playing on the tennis team, and he did a research project that looked at the carbon footprint of the tennis team over the course of a season. And it was really huge. And of course, it made a much bigger difference if they were flying than if they were, you know, taking a bus, and if they were seeing, you know, all the schools around them at the same time versus going differently. And I think that we all could really sit down and maybe, is there a tool that you can look at your carbon footprint? Because it would seem that we have to take it seriously ourselves if we're really going to advocate making a difference in society.
Right. So just Google carbon footprint tool, and there are a lot of different tools that one could find.
Carbon footprint tool.
Along the lines that you were just talking, it's very interesting that the healthcare sector is one of the largest generators of greenhouse gas emissions. It's such a huge sector of the economy, and it turns out that it's also very energy intensive. So that's one thing that some people here are trying to consciously work on, to reduce the carbon footprint of Yale New Haven Hospital and to think more broadly about how the sector in general could reduce its carbon footprint.
If you could leave our listeners with just one final thought, what would that be?
This is a very difficult problem because it's long-term, it's global in scale, meaning that whether there's carbon dioxide being emitted in New Haven, Connecticut, or in Beijing, China, makes no difference. It affects the whole world. It's also a very difficult problem because the most powerful industry in the history of the world, that being the fossil fuel industry, is unfortunately standing in the way, through lobbying, through promoting climate denial, through other mechanisms, and now standing in the way with the full support of the U.S. administration. So that makes it a hugely difficult problem. But on the other hand, it's a problem that we really have to solve. We really have no choice. And so we need to work even harder. And so I'd urge your listeners to get involved.
Well, we appreciate you getting involved, Dr. Robert Dubrow. Your decisions to change and devote time, resources, intellectual capital, and certainly directing students into projects that can improve the situation. So thank you for being a guest on Your Health.
Well, thanks very much. It was great talking to you.
We've been talking with Dr. Robert Dubrow, professor of epidemiology at Yale School of Public Health, about climate and health initiatives. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Quaither. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And Bob, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they just send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question about something that's actually pretty scary, someone passing out.
So our first question is from a listener who says, my 14-year-old daughter recently passed out during a soccer practice. It had been a hard practice, and we did go to the doctor who did not find anything wrong, but I'm still unsettled. Do you have any thoughts?
Well, I'd say that passing out can be a very ominous symptom of things, often not, most often not. But I'm glad that you saw your doctor and got some progress started on it. You know, the most common reasons for that situation could be dehydration, that she was working really hard at practice and not drinking enough water, that she hadn't been eating much and her blood sugar got low. But there are things like cardiac arrhythmias that can cause it too. And so there are things that you can look up.
Yeah. You know, Bob and I will frequently say common things happen commonly. You know, someone working out too hard and getting a little faint or low blood sugar. And uncommon things happen uncommonly, like the arrhythmias. But uncommon things can happen. There's a condition, usually see it in people who are a little bit older, called Brugada's. And we read about this in medical school, but it's not like we see cases a lot. And that's where you get a lengthening of the rhythm part of the heart. And so you can get these rhythm disturbances. And, you know, that's where sometimes people can have things like sudden death. So, you know, it's good to be seen by your local doctor. I would have encouraged, if not done, an EKG and maybe a little more workup, depending on if it's happened, you know, certainly if it happened a second time, then I might even see a cardiologist and have some testing done, because this isn't normal. On the other hand, hopefully it doesn't come back.
I agree. And 14-year-olds are out in the world, and falling down is putting yourself at risk of head trauma and all kinds of different things. So if it happens again, I agree, Adam. With Adam, that we need to work it up.
Laura, what's our very next house call about someone who's not really exercising very much?
The next house call is, I always hear about how bad sedentary lifestyles are for your health, but I have a job that requires me to be glued to a computer all day long. How can I balance my work with a more active lifestyle?
Well, you know what the name for this is, Bob. We call it someone who just sits on a couch all day.
A couch potato.
Couch potato. How'd they get that name?
Because it's carbs. I don't know.
It could be. That's as good of an answer as I've ever heard. None of us want to be a couch potato, right?
That's a fact. So here's the deal. If you got a job that's going to hold you in front of a computer screen and you're not moving around, then you have to change your life to make that happen. And I would say, you know, find some time that you can dedicate to walking, running, any other activity that you like to do. I think you might find somebody else to do it with you, and that'll probably enhance your dedication to getting it done if you both commit to each other.
I was talking with a colleague the other day, Bob. We were talking about some research, and I noticed her voice kind of went a little bit in, a little bit out, a little bit in, a little bit out. And I'm like, are you running right now? She goes, well, I'm on the treadmill. I said, well, how are you talking with me? Because we're talking about research, and we're going through some slides. She goes, oh, I'm doing it in my office. And I've got my computer screen in front of me, and I'm like, wow, that's impressive. And then I realized, you know, there's so many different ways we can be sedentary. You can have the treadmill. You can also have, like, monitors where you actually are. You could be sitting down but continue to move your feet. We talk about exercises while you're sitting, moving your arms and your legs. Playing video games doesn't quite cut it, nor does watching TV.
I agree.
So we want, for all the reasons, all the cardiovascular benefits, stroke prevention benefits, diabetes benefits, all of those things to avoid this. And, you know, I'd say get up and go with a friend. It seems like it's a lot easier to go to the gym with a friend than to go there by yourself even. Laura, what's our very next house call?
This listener asks, after years of wearing high heels to work, I'm suffering the consequences with foot pain that affects me nearly every day. What could be the cause and what should I do?
It could be that you've got arthritis in your feet. There's a long list, but that's probably right at the top if you've been doing this all your life. I'd be curious what happens when you're in your sneakers. Does it quit hurting? And if so, I'd find a way to try to simulate that with a pair of dress shoes that are flat or at least have a heel that is pretty good size so you're not wobbling on your ankle.
Yeah, you know, you wonder if they, you know, our shoe manufacturers couldn't develop a high heel that sometimes goes down when you're not with someone, you know, and then it goes back up when you need it or something. And the problem is here, is it the heel or is it the arch of the foot? Because it could actually be the heel. We get lots of people get Achilles tendonitis, inflammation of that tendon right in the back of the heel there. And that can be pretty painful and difficult to treat. You need to treat it differently than, you know, stretching, massage. Good for both, but you probably need to see someone.
Could also be plantar fasciitis, which is nicely addressed with a shot of steroids. So, that, you know, if it's a problem, get it looked at and see if there's something you can do about it.
See if you can get the doctor to write you a note that you shouldn't or that you can wear different shoes if you can. Laura, what's our very last house call?
I have several moles, and I get them checked yearly by a dermatologist, but I'm wondering what the easiest things to watch out for in between appointments that might indicate a problem.
Well, this is a great question and one that Bob and I take seriously. I know, Bob, you've taken off many melanomas throughout your career. I've taken off melanomas. My wife's a dermatologist. We see and want to prevent skin cancer, particularly the worst type of skin cancer called melanoma, but also other types of skin cancers that are sun-related. And the biggest thing is there a mole that's new or is it changing?
I agree. And it's particularly important for changing moles that have a color that changes along with the mole or bleeds into the normal adjacent skin around it. And if things itch, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but the change in the diameter.
It wasn't itching before. Now, all of a sudden, it started itching. That's a mole that's irritated.
Right. So you need to get it looked at, and you've done that. But watch out for changes.
Yeah, I was seeing someone, meeting someone the other day, Bob, and I never met them before. And I noticed as they kind of put their hand up in the air, I saw a dark mole on their palm. And they had no other moles I could see on their hand or their arm. And, you know, it went down real quick. And I just said, how long has that mole been there? Excuse me, that mole on your palm. And I think I was a little taken back. They said, oh, it's been there many, many years. I said, has it changed? And they looked at it and they said, well, yeah, it's been getting bigger. Well, that's something you have to go get checked out because even though it could have been there a long time, it could have been benign, non-cancerous. If it's changing, may or may not be worrisome, but let someone take a look at it and a biopsy if they need be. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. And we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to your health. You can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or search Your Health, one word, for a free download of our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our guest today, Dr. Robert Dubrow, and our great guest co-host, Dr. Bob Gwyther. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Bob Gwyther.
And look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.